The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Tuesday, September the 2nd. I'm Belinda Rhodes. On today's podcast, at an emergency meeting in Brussels, EU leaders condemn Russia's invasion of Georgia and its recognition of the breakaway states, but stop short of concrete action.
Really, it's up to Russia to decide what it wants to do, whether it wants a values-based relationship with Europe or whether it wants to isolate itself.
Hurricane Gustav slams into Louisiana's coast as a Category 2 storm, but getting out of town was still a smart move.
Winds are probably exceeding 80 miles per hour in their gusts right now. There's down power lines, down trees. One of my colleagues is actually outside of the vehicle trying to stand up right now, and he's getting blown around pretty good.
And which sky blue football team now has this colourful character on its board?
He's 31, claims to have been a sort of child chess genius, runs a reality TV programme in Abu Dhabi in the kind of Alan Sugar mode in which American executives fight against UK executives.
That's all coming up, but first, a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
Gordon Brown will launch the first phase of his autumn economic fight back with a £1 billion plan to help homeowners. The Prime Minister's unveiling a package of measures to revive the ailing property market, targeting first-time buyers and vulnerable families. It includes a mortgage rescue scheme for those at risk of repossession and a shared equity proposal where the government and developers will offer loans of up to 30%. Downing Street hopes this will focus attention on help for struggling families after a bruising weekend during which the Chancellor, in an interview for The Guardian, warned Britain faced arguably the worst economic conditions in 60 years. A state of emergency has been declared in Thailand. The Prime Minister's given the army control of public order after a man died in overnight clashes between pro- and anti-government protesters in Bangkok. Samex under Ravage expects the measures to only last for a few days. It's the country's worst violence since the People's Alliance for Democracy launched its street campaign against the Prime Minister in May. The deployment of troops now raises the spectre of an army seizure of power less than 2 years after the military kicked out the then Prime Minister, Thaksin Shinawatra. Hurricane Gustav has delivered only a glancing blow to New Orleans. A weaker-than-expected storm crashed ashore as a Category 2 hurricane with 110-mile-an-hour winds. It's now been downgraded to a tropical storm with maximum gusts of 60 miles an hour. Forecasters now expect it to weaken further as it moves towards northeastern Texas. Authorities are reporting a total of 8 deaths related to the storm. Russia's warned the West against further support for Georgia's leadership. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's also calling for an arms embargo against the ex-Soviet republic until a different government's in place. His comments came several hours before EU leaders agreed to postpone talks with Russia unless the Kremlin pulls its troops back from positions in Georgia. We'll have more on this from The Guardian's Europe correspondent in just a moment. And Manchester City have broken the British football transfer record after signing Real Madrid's Robinho late last night. It's thought the Brazilian forward cost them about £32 million. It says the club moves closer to a takeover by a consortium from Abu Dhabi. It means the Blues have managed to steal the limelight from rivals Manchester United, who've successfully captured Dimitar Berbatov from Spurs. Although United haven't confirmed how much they've paid for the 27-year-old, Tottenham say it's nearly £31 million. As part of the deal, White Hart Lane have agreed not to pursue a complaint against United for making an illegal approach. For all the transfer details, go to guardian.co.uk/football. And Manchester City make the front pages of The Independent. It says the Gulf ruler buys the club, then reveals his plans to spend, spend, spend. Football also makes the front of The Sun with a picture of Manchester United's Alex Ferguson driving Berbatov in his Bentley, presumably trying to ensure the transfer went through. The headline reads, "Taxi for Berbatov." Its back page suggests United could now be fined and deducted points over the deal. The Mirror's back page reads, "It's Middle East lands," as the takeover deal at Manchester City catapults them into football's elite. Away from football, in the Times pictures John McCain's running mate Sarah Palin after she's forced to admit her school-aged daughter is 5 months pregnant. The FT covers the pound falling to an all-time record against the euro. It says the Chancellor's dire economic warning in The Guardian is partly to blame. The Express covers the same story as its lead, suggesting Gordon Brown is losing patience with his Chancellor, with the Mail chipping in saying sterling's also a two-year low against the dollar. Finishing with an exclusive in The Telegraph, which says, under the Tories, you could inherit £2 million tax-free. It also covers a study on another form of inheritance, which claims a gene makes divorce more likely. And more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
EU leaders met in Brussels yesterday for their first emergency meeting since the invasion of Iraq in 2003 to discuss how to respond to Russia's invasion of Georgia. The leaders condemned Russia's actions in Georgia and its recognition of the breakaway states of South Ossetia and Abkhazia, but decided against imposing sanctions. They called on Russia to fully adhere to the peace deal brokered by the French, and French President Nicolas Sarkozy said he would be returning to Moscow and Georgia to continue his efforts to resolve the conflict. Ian Traynor in Brussels has more on the mood of the talks.
Quite fast, quite brisk. It was an emergency summit, of course, so there was a determination that there shouldn't be a repeat of that fiasco this time, and it seems that basically while the 27 member states of the Union are in such a certain degree divided over policy on Russia, the consensus did hold, it seemed, and was probably more united than might have been expected. The results, basically, two results, the launch of a new mediation mission next week to Moscow by President Nicolas Sarkozy of France, accompanied by Barroso, the Commission Chief, and Solana, the European Foreign Policy Chief. They're going to the Kremlin next Monday for make-or-break talks, both on the Georgia conflict and more broadly on the kind of underlying nature of Europe's relationship with Russia. So that's quite important. And in the meantime, basically, they suspended some technical negotiations on a new partnership, kind of strategic pact, governing relations between Europe and Russia until such times as the ceasefire in Georgia is properly observed by the Russians. So they're the two real results, but in fact that's probably more than might have been expected.
So, but do they really amount to anything? I mean, why, for example, did they stop short of calling for sanctions?
Well, never really were calling for sanctions. Some people have been calling for sanctions, but sanctions perhaps the wrong word. I mean, when you talk sanctions, you think trade or economic sanctions. Europe is not really in a position to impose sanctions on Russia. It's too big, too important. Europe and Russia are way too interdependent in terms of energy supplies and consumption, basically gas and oil. So there was never really great support for sanctions against Russia. It was never really on the cards. More crucially and more fundamentally, is basically what Sarkozy has been saying is basically it takes two to tango in this umbilical relationship between Russia and Europe. And the conflict in Georgia has basically rewritten the rules of that relationship, and really it's up to Russia to decide what it wants to do, whether it wants a values-based relationship with Europe or whether it wants to isolate itself. And these are tough questions, and they're not easy questions to answer, and they certainly wouldn't be answered in a three-hour meeting in Brussels.
And you can follow developments on that story throughout the day at guardian.co.uk/Russia. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, as the 25th teenager killed in London this year, Shaquille Maitland-Smith, is described as the innocent victim of a long-running gang war, there's an in-depth feature on knife crime in the capital. That's at guardian.co.uk/news. At guardian.co.uk/comment is free, Matthew Taylor has some thoughts for Gordon Brown. He says that an economic downturn can be a creative opportunity and tells him how to make the best of it. And at guardian.co.uk/money, there's an interactive guide to the recent house price falls.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Flouting the worst of predictions, Hurricane Gustav crashed into the coast of Louisiana yesterday as a Category 2 storm. Nonetheless, most of the residents of New Orleans and the surrounding area will be glad they left town. The eye of the storm hit land about 50 miles southwest of New Orleans, whipping up some appalling weather for the state's fishing and oil industry. As the eye was approaching Franklin, Louisiana, we spoke to storm chaser Joel Taylor of TornadoVideos.net, who was there to film the storm.
We are on the
eye wall right now too. The eye is about to is approaching us from the southeast and should be here the next 5 to 10 minutes. We've got really intense rainfall right now, along with strong winds. Winds are probably exceeding 80 miles per hour in their gusts right now. There's down power lines, down trees. One of my colleagues is actually outside of the vehicle trying to stand up right now, and he's getting blown around pretty good. We spent last night in Lafayette, Louisiana, and then this morning made the trek down here. There are pretty much no vehicles. Nobody's out on the roads at all. We're about the only vehicle we've seen out driving around in this storm. Been pretty lucky. It looked like the storm was going to be a much, much stronger storm yesterday when it made landfall today in Louisiana, but fortunately it weakened some overnight over the last couple of days after it crossed Cuba. It weakened some and was not able to regain that Category 4 strength that it had coming into Cuba. So that really helped out, as well as it passed south of New Orleans far enough that New Orleans was able to be spared the brunt of the storm. Could have been a much, much worse situation up there if things had played out a little differently.
And now that it's been downgraded to a Category 2 storm, what kind of damage can that cause?
With a Category 2 storm, you'd expect like mobile homes, a lot of damage to mobile homes, to roofs, down power lines, trees down. You're not going to expect total destruction to buildings like you might see in a Category 4 or Category 5 storm. But, you know, roofs definitely can be damaged, maybe some glass, broken windows, things like that. Makes it really hard to drive because, obviously, with the wind that strong, we're getting blown all over the road as we're trying to maneuver around the storm. But the damage, obviously, could have been much, much worse. A lot of times with hurricane, the most damaging part will be the storm surge, which is the wall of water that comes in with the storm. With a Category 4 or 5 storm, that could be up to 20 feet deep. So you basically have a 20-foot wall of water coming on shore. With this storm, it was probably closer maybe to 10 feet right at the coast, and then once you get inland, you actually lose that storm surge. So with this storm itself, we're very fortunate that it did weaken. Otherwise, you know, obviously things could have been much, much worse.
So do you think people will be glad that they evacuated, or do you think people could actually have stayed home?
With a storm like this, there's no reason to ever take the chance. You know, it could have just as easily been a much stronger storm. And, you know, there's no need to take the chance. If it looks like there's that possibility, you definitely want to get out of the way. With us, we've chased about 10 hurricanes. We have a pretty good idea what we're doing. If the storm was stronger, we would not be out driving around. We would have taken shelter in a building that was with reinforced concrete to stay safe. But, you know, the average citizen with a storm like this coming on shore definitely needs to get out of the way just to make sure they're going to be safe.
And how quickly after the storm has passed will it be safe for them to return?
Actually, probably later today, as the storm continues coming inland, it should weaken rapidly. So definitely by tomorrow, I would expect people to start coming back into this area, back into New Orleans and in parts of southern Louisiana, and it should be safe by then.
Joel Taylor there. Well, despite being less severe than expected, Hurricane Gustave did pull the rug from under the Republican National Convention hundreds of miles away in Minnesota. The schedule for the first day was shortened, and appearances by President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney were cancelled. Here's Ben Green with a roundup of the day's events there.
Yes, Hurricane Gustave ensured that the weather took precedence over presidents as the RNC got off to an extremely low-key start. John McCain spent the day in Ohio at a Christian charity organisation, while George Bush, who was due to give a valedictory address to the convention, was in Texas observing the relief up close.
The coordination on this storm is a lot better than during Katrina.
And just as New Orleans is something of a ghost town after the city's mass evacuation, so too here in St. Paul it's a little quiet, to say the least. Whereas it took between 1 and 4 hours to get through the security perimeter in Denver for the Democratic National Convention, here there's virtually no lines whatsoever. At some points it seemed that conference staff in their bright red t-shirts outnumbered the delegates, and really the only people about are the police, talk radio hosts, dyed-in-the-wool Republicans wearing cowboy hats and waving placards about God, patriotism and morality, and a few other conservative types not conforming to that stereotype at all.
I'm John Lee from Boring, Oregon. I really think that they should have gone on with the speeches. I think the speeches could have been modified to think about and pray for those that are being affected by the storm. people here at the convention, you know, we're 2,000 miles away. There's not much we can do for a storm that's hitting New Orleans. We all care and we all want to do something about it. But quite frankly, I think the speeches should have gone on and that they should have been, you know, modified in such a way that we did look at what's going on down there.
Obama has a lot of charisma. He has youth on his side. He's got a very positive message of change. What's John McCain bringing to the table?
Getting back to our roots, having experience, knowing how to deal with national and international leaders. You know, you look at Obama's credentials, and he just doesn't have any. He talks change, but he doesn't say what he wants to change. That scares the hell out of me, quite frankly. You know, and quite frankly, with John McCain picking Sarah Barracuda, you know, I think we have some charisma, and I think we have some change on our side, too.
Now, considering the Republicans are expecting around 35,000 people at this convention, it appears that no one mentioned this to the city of St. Paul itself. You'd be amazed by how many locals I've spoken to who had no idea that McCain and the GOP were coming to town. Street hawkers and shop owners too seem somewhat embarrassed to be selling their McCain, Sarah Palin memorabilia. One sign I saw earlier declared, "The selling of this merchandise does not represent this store's political affiliation." But one thing that is absolutely abundant around here is the American flag. Everywhere you look, there are stars and stripes and the good old red, white, and blue. And where last week the Democrats' message was about hope, change, and restoring the American dream, here the buzz from the generally much older crowd is security, the steady hand of leadership, and national pride.
National security, first of all, I was a survivor of 9/11. So national security is number one because I saw how we were almost all gone. So national security is number one. You don't have anything else with it. Economics, nothing else counts but keeping strong and alive.
National security is probably the first obligation of a president to protect its citizenry.
McCain choosing to be president, everything is country first with him, then family and everything else second. He loves his country. He's served in many ways. And so the first thing, it's your country.
How will John McCain, if he gets voted in as president, how is he going to restore pride in the American flag, particularly abroad?
Well, I think he's demonstrated this week that he has decisive executive leadership skills. He is a genuine hero that I think people respect all over the world right now.
Pride in the flag? Well, I'm a retired teacher, and I believe that we need to teach it. Because if children don't learn it at an early age, then they don't grow up to defend the flag.
This is our country, and we need to serve our country. We need to put our country first, and we need to do everything we can, because our country's been a great blessing to all of us. There's no country like this in the whole world.
Ben Green there in Minnesota.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
I'm Belinda Rhodes. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, why stone statues of a warrior and a bureaucrat are no match for Michelangelo's David. But first, financial muscle looks like being the name of the game at Manchester City over the coming weeks and months after a huge company, backed by the royal family of the United Arab Emirates, bought the club from former Thai Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat. The new owners, Abu Dhabi United Group, look likely to bring improbable amounts of money to the club, possibly changing its future forever. I asked Kevin McCarra, our chief football writer, to tell us more about them and their representative on City's board, Dr. Suleiman Al-Fahim.
Well, Suleiman Al-Fahim is somebody we hadn't heard of course, and no doubt we'll become more suspicious of him in days to come. But at present, he seems a highly colourful individual. He's 31, claims to be a sort of child chess genius, runs a reality TV programme in Abu Dhabi in the kind of Alan Sugar mode in which American executives fight against UK executives. He's extraordinarily wealthy through property, and taking over Man City is a mere bagatelle in his portfolio.
So where does this leave Thaksin Shinawat?
Well, the timing is not entirely a surprise, although the buyer is, but Thaksin possibly facing extradition to Thailand following criminal proceedings there, and money in Thailand basically frozen in bank accounts, was in some difficulties. We knew he would sell at least part of Man City, but a complete sale of the whole shebang did take us by surprise.
You mentioned that Suleiman al-Fahim and his company have extraordinary amounts of money to put up. So what kind of signings will they be looking for?
Well, I think the amazement's just kept on coming. No sooner had we been introduced to him, as it were, than we heard they were going to vie with Manchester United to buy Dimitar Berbatov from Spurs, and had indeed at that point outbid Manchester United by offering $30 million. Recently, there's been lots of rumours about Man City having to sell players, hotly denied, and now it seems they can afford just about anyone. And indeed, the stated intention of Suleiman al-Fahim is for Man City to be playing in the Champions League next season. So there's no time to spare.
Reports put the price paid by this Arab consortium as high as $200 million. That would represent a massive profit for Taksin.
Well, it's incredible. We understand that Taksin maybe spent about $40 million and promised to put some more money in. So really, you're talking about somebody perhaps quadrupling their money and at the same time getting out of a tight corner.
And what position will this put Manchester City in general? Will this bring stability to the club?
Well, I mean, it's cruel to say, but they are always regarded as a kind of comedy club where kind of crazy things happen. But this time it's crazy in a sort of wonderful way if you're a Man City supporter. They have a large stadium. The northwest of the country is quite attractive. I think a team called Manchester United have proved you can be successful in that environment. And so long as Suleiman al-Fahim is true to his word about pouring money into the club, then I think success eventually is almost inevitable.
And what do you think fans will think? I mean, obviously, it gives them a huge boost and gives them a lot of opportunities. But, you know, isn't it a bit sad that it all boils down to money in the end?
I think it is sad. I think there's many people throughout the game think, well, that's now about half the Premier League in foreign hands. I don't mean to be xenophobic about it. It's not so much nationality as the fact that these are people who usually didn't have any connection with football at all. And therefore, you lose that sense of heritage and tradition, which is what made English football great in the first place. But If it was my club and somebody came in and bought all the best players for my team, I could swallow it.
And that was Kevin McCarra.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
When the city of Florence in Italy gave Ningbo in China a beautiful gift to boost trade ties, it was feted with fireworks and live television coverage of the unveiling. It was a bronze reproduction of Michelangelo's David statue, a work in which both sides could see the artistic merit. The trouble started when Ningbo gave Florence a gift in return. The fortunate people of Florence, with their vast collection of Renaissance art, were not so enamoured with what they received, as our reporter Tom Kington explains.
The two statues, which are almost 4 metres high and could be considered rather far removed from the kind of statues you'd see in Florence today, have yet to find a home because the local residents' associations, who have some say over the land where these statues were to be erected, have put their foot down and said, we don't think these are in keeping with the city, we don't particularly like them, and so we'd rather not have them, which is causing a great deal of embarrassment, given that the Chinese delegation are due in Florence on September the 25th to proudly witness the unveiling of these statues.
Well, what exactly is the problem with these statues?
The statues, which weigh about 4 tons each, depict two figures. They are reproductions of statues from the Tang Dynasty era. One is a bureaucrat and the other is a soldier, and they reportedly represent the two aspects of the power of the state, military and civil. They're both smiling rather nicely. One is the soldier is clutching a sword and the bureaucrat is standing with his hands pressed together. They could be considered beautiful and aesthetically suitable if you're perhaps not from Florence and not used to the Renaissance statues which punctuate the city here. So really, I think it's just down to a matter of taste.
Right, so what kind of a solution do you think might be found to this problem?
Since the cat is now out of the bag and Florence officials know that the Chinese are well aware of the problems, I don't think that they'll be able to get up to any funny business, perhaps putting them up temporarily and then whipping them down the moment the Chinese have gone. In fact, today, Florence newspaper Corriere Fiorentino rang one of the Chinese officials, Chen Wenfei, to ask his views on this problem, and he said that he was really unhappy about these problems. And he said, however, that we're sure that the city and the officials there will find a solution in time for our visit.
Do you think there's a bit of snobbery here? I mean, is there really anything wrong with the statues? And has anyone locally been saying, actually, look, they're not that bad?
The people who have been questioned by journalists up there seem to be genuinely contrary to the idea. And in fact, the paper Corriere Fiorentino published a survey today, survey findings, in which readers were asked, what should we do with these statues? And 89.9% of those people responding said, send them back to China.
And are the Italians afraid in any way of what of the Chinese taking revenge? I mean, what might happen to the Statue of David in China if these Chinese statues are rejected?
There have been hints that that there are fears up at the mayor's office that the Chinese might do what the Iraqis did to the statues of Saddam. There could be a mob hauling the Statue of David down soon if these statues over in Florence don't find a home.
That was Tom Kington in Rome. And that's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 a.m. Producing today, Sonia Rothwell and Andy Duckworth. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.